Let's talk on the phone a little bit later, because I can't talk here.
The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, the date is February 23rd, Thursday, 2012, and we do have quorum. The agenda today, we were going to start with Senator Nenow. He's not here yet. Senate File 1958, a bill that I am proposing, will go first. Senator Newman, would you take the gavel?
Senator Limmer, are you ready to proceed?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Senate File 1958 is a bill that addresses an omission that was created quite some time ago. As people may remember, there is a provision under firearm background checks that, or we have a firearm background check at any time that someone wants to own a firearm, especially pistols. But for some reason, we did not include the compound of explosive gunpowder or other explosives in requiring a background check when someone wishes to purchase that. And this simply expands the law to include an explosives background check when it comes to data that may prohibit an individual from that purchase. We have people from the department, the appropriate department, in order to explain further the technicality of the bill.
And that is Ms. Engler, I believe. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Katie Engler. I'm with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And really, the bill is even more technical than Senator Limmer has led you to believe, in that explosives to purchase explosives or to possess them, one currently needs a background check. The language that's before you today in Senate File 1958 allows law enforcement agencies who conduct those checks to use an electronic means to query the Minnesota Department of Human Services whether or not there are records there that need to be pursued. And so really this is a permission for an electronic querying function to be used by law enforcement in conducting those checks. And it doesn't change the data that are available. It just streamlines how the data are acquired. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Engler, I notice on the summary that has been prepared for us, there's a reference to conducting a background checks for possession of black powder. There's a number of folks that I know, including myself, that have hunted with black powder over the years. Will this bill require a background check of someone who is legally hunting with a black powder rifle in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at Minnesota Statute Section 299F, like Frank, 0.785, and that speaks of people manufacturing, assembling, having a warehouse, or storing black powder for purposes of wholesale or retail sale. And that is those are the activities that require the background check. So I believe the answer to your question is no.
Thank you, Ms. Engler. Mr. Backus, just to put me at ease, Ms. Engler said she believes that to be the case, and I want to be certain. Would you be able to give us any help on this issue?
Mr. Chair and members, I guess I would echo what Ms. Engler said. I mean, this doesn't put any new background check requirements. There's a current background, that's already required for the people that Ms. Engler mentioned, so it wouldn't apply to people using it for other purposes other than what she said for wholesale or retail sale.
So Mr. Backus specifically would not, this background check would not apply to people who obtain a hunting license in the state of Minnesota for purposes and using black powder for hunting purposes?
Mr. Chairman, members, that's my understanding, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Backus. Any other committee members have any questions? Seeing none, any final comments?
Senator Chairman, I would like to move Senate File 1958.
And where is it going?
We recommend it to pass and be sent to the floor. Senate floor.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. Senator Limmer has moved Senate File 1958 be recommended to pass and move to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted, and the bill is on its way to the
Thank
floor.
You, Mr.
Thank you, Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Thompson.
Nino.
Oh, is Nino. Senator Nino.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have the bill before the committee today. I think is just a technical change. It's what seems to be the intent of the legislative change in prior sessions was not properly applied. So this bill is changing that to make sure that the statute is fully in compliance with what the legislature intended to do. And we do have a representative here that would like to speak to that from the county attorney's perspective.
Welcome to the committee. Would you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, thank you. My name is Tara Ferguson Lopez, and I'm assistant Mille Lacs County attorney. And I'm here on behalf of this bill. In my role as county attorney from Mille Lacs County, I've run into a couple different issues where this has come to the forefront in the district court. One case is now pending in the appellate courts. Essentially, the issue just seeks to correct what we believe is a legislative oversight. It doesn't make any substantive changes to the statute. We're still proceeding and charging the same way we always have, but it's been attacked based on the renumbering of the statute that was done in, I believe, 2007. And so we're asking that this committee forward this bill on and support it to avoid future litigation with regard to this particular subdivision in the statute.
Is there any discussion on the bill? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Hearing none. Senator Newman, would you move Senate File 1825 and be moved to the consent calendar?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman moves that Senate File 1825 be recommended to pass and move to the Senate floor via the consent calendar. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you,
Senator Neal.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson. Senate File 1298, this bill regarding state agencies, civil penalty impositions, regulations, and prevailing party fees and expense awards. Anytime you are ready, Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am here today, as you know, to discuss Senate File 1298, which deals with civil penalties against state agencies. And one of the common themes of this legislative session, as well as the 2011 session, is to attempt to create as positive a business environment as we can in this state, thereby creating a positive environment for employees and workers and hiring. And so this bill deals directly with that. One of the significant impediments to business is when agencies become overzealous and get in the way, frankly, of businesses doing their jobs or impose unreasonable penalties, and that is what this bill deals with.
Senator Thompson, could I interrupt you for a moment? Do you have an author's amendment?
I do. I have an author's amendment, and I believe that would be the A2 amendment, and I would move that at this time.
Senator Thompson moves the A2 amendment as a delete everything amendment. This is an author's amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are three primary things that this bill does, and I will describe them very briefly, and then I have a gentleman with me that will testify. First, it expands the number and the nature of the factors that must be considered by an agency when assessing a penalty against the subject of an investigation. So there are additional factors that have to be considered before such a penalty can be asserted. Then there is a requirement also that the factors that have been taken into consideration be documented so that the subject of the investigation is aware of the reasons for the conclusion that was come to. And then finally, and the provision that I believe members really puts the teeth into this bill, is that in the event that a party is assessed a fine and they dispute it and they take it into our court system, and ultimately they are assessed a penalty that is substantially less than the agency was looking for, that the subject of the investigation would be able to recover their fees, their attorney fees, and related costs. So the bottom line is what we're doing is we're trying to make certain that the agencies take the proper factors into account when determining what kind of a penalty is to assess, and document those factors so that they are accountable for the criteria that they have used to make their decision. And then if they assess a penalty that turns out to be out of line with the final judgment on that penalty, so that it seems as though there was an overreach, that they're going to have to cover the costs to that the subject of the investigation that had to fight that. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to take questions. I think first it might make sense to hear from Mr. Joe Matanowski, who I brought in here to speak to the bill, if it please the chair.
Mr. Matanowski, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Joseph Matanowski. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis at the Heshton McAsee firm.
Please proceed.
Thank you for inviting me here today, Senator Thompson, to speak in support of this bill. By way of background, I started my legal career over 25 years ago in the Attorney General's office as a prosecutor representing the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. 7 years into my career, I moved to private practice, and I've been working in the environmental field, so I represent many businesses. Because environmental issues are very complicated, I represent small businesses, and they run into these penalty issues frequently. And it's very tough on small businesses to deal with these penalty assessments. And sometimes there's a lack of explanation. Those individuals find themselves in court. And so this bill would specify factors that the agencies are to consider in determining civil penalties and have some balance in that, and provide notice to the parties of what those factors are in penalty determinations. It's a key issue that's affected many parties. I had a client a number of years ago that faced a $62,000 penalty demand for some hazardous waste tank violations. They ended up offering $6,200, were told no. The agency then said, we're going to court, we're seeking $100,000. After a trial, the judge, district court judge, said these violations are really $3,500 in that case. They were able to recover their fees under the other part of the EAJA, the Equal Access to Justice Act. They made a case that the state's case was substantially unjustified. This bill would provide relief in that case of an excessive demand. When there is an excessive demand, a judge could determine that that party's fees and costs would be paid under the Equal Access to Justice Act. I want to advise you that it doesn't mean that every case this is going to happen. The district court judge or the administrative law judge hearing a matter, I believe, is in the best position to determine whether a demand has been excessive. And it would, in addition to being excessive, it would have to be determined by the court to be unreasonable. And if there was a willful violation or if a defendant protracted a case and didn't conduct themselves reasonably or there were special circumstances, the court could say there is no award of attorney's fees. So it is an act that primarily benefits small business who are impacted by many of these rules and regulations.
Thank you. Any further discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I've also brought Mr. Mike Hickey from the National Federation of Independent Businesses to also address the bill.
Mr. Hickey, pardon me, Mr. Hickey, welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business, and we're the state's largest small business group, as you know, and also the largest group in terms of entities with about 12,000 members. And we just want to thank Senator Thompson for authoring this bill. Representative Westrum had it in the House, and it was one of the things the House was trying to do regarding dealing with rules and regulations and penalties and trying to create a more positive regulatory environment in our state, and we strongly support the bill. I'm not going to be redundant on the testimony, but more flexibility in penalizing people is a good thing. Ultimately, the agency can do what they're going to do and is going to do what they're going to do, but more flexibility in considering the factors and documenting it for those being penalized will be helpful. And we're really encouraged by the expansion of the Equal Access to Justice Law. Law's been around a long time. There hasn't been a lot of cases. I think we need to point that out on the fiscal note. There's maybe been 50 or 100 cases. Mr. Matternowski tracks this more than me, but maybe 50 to 100 cases since its inception in the 1980s. It's had a long history of bipartisan involvement. Senator Reich got young, carried a bill. Senator Betzold carried a bill on this. But what this aspect does today, it says that in the excessive demand provision, as Mr. Matternowski talked about, where you know, asking for 100 and getting 3,500, asking for $4,000 in penalty and $100,000 in unworkable corrective action, having the judge throw it all out and only penalize that party $4,000, puts small business owners in a situation where they can see their financial life flashing in front of them. If I have to take a second mortgage out of my house, is college out for my kid, whatever, how am I going to deal with a $100,000 penalty and with my family situation? And so these things can really jar people, can be very intimidating. Obviously, the government's got a budget to watch, but they're not billing by the hour. The small business is. And so the recovery provided under this law is really important, and it has saved the financial lives of some businesses in very dire cases. And so strongly support the bill, and I want to thank Senator Thompson for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Is there further testimony for or against the bill? Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hickey, how does a company with $7 million in revenue and 500 employees see their financial life pass before their eyes and have to take out a mortgage on a home in order to pay a $100,000 penalty? And how would that affect a $30 million company, which is what the bill expands? I don't know how a $30 million company is a small business anyway. I got a small business. I'm a solo practitioner. That's small. $30 million? I'd accept all the regulation you want to give me.
You don't have $30 million in gross sales?
I'm working on it, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hickey?
Senator Latz, that's the upper end of it. Obviously, we also have people with no real employees and family workers or one or two employees. We made a big error back when we worked with Senator Reich got young on this. We tried to capture the federal definition, which is up to 500 employees and then a net worth standard. And was that 7, I believe? But we mixed it up, and so we got half the federal definition right. So 500 employees and $7 million in sales doesn't make any sense to anybody, you know, who's knowledgeable about business. If you have $7 million in revenue and 500 employees, you're not going to have 500 employees very long. You're going to be passing out pink slips faster than you can imagine. And so the definition is out of sync. And so we didn't want to go to a net worth standard, Senator Latz, because a large company in the thralls of bankruptcy might qualify somehow. You know, who knows what their net worth is on a given day if this company's collapsing. So we were trying to stick with easily understandable concepts of number of employees and a revenue target. And so with 500, we have 500 from the old law. 30 million we thought was a good target for 500. 7 million would be a good target for maybe 25 or 50 employees. So the definition's out of whack, and we're trying to correct it.
Mr. Latz?
Mr. Chairman, even with $7 million in revenue, I would think a company that's in a business that's regulated by the PCA ought to be able to handle a $100,000 penalty if it were ever to come to that.
Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Mr. Matarowski.
Yes.
I'm looking at, just to help you, on page 3, subparagraph B, I've got two questions. The first is, not all contested cases come to a final decision by an ALJ. There are some, but not all. In those cases where an ALJ is only permitted by law to make a recommendation to the commissioner of an agency, how will this bill help you in that instance?
Senator Newman, I believe the intent of the bill is to cover that situation. My understanding of the OAH processes with administrative law judges is that in most matters they only make a recommendation back to the commissioner, and the commissioner reviews that, may issue separate findings of fact, conclusions of law, and then the order becomes final. There are rules governing the Equal Access to Justice Act that have been adopted by the OAH. So this provision would fit right into that already existing rulemaking procedure.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Matarnowski, I would invite you to maybe look into that a little bit. What you have described would not necessarily be the same as my understanding. There are a number of different kinds of state agency contested cases in which a final decision is binding by an ALJ, and many that are not. And the way I am reading this, it would appear to me that in those situations where the ALJ is making a final decision, it's going to help you. But in the cases where an ALJ makes a recommendation procedurally, the final decision in those cases will be made by the commissioner, and I'm not seeing where it's going to help you. My second question. On line 3.3, it says, in a civil action arising from a state agency, can you tell me what kind of civil actions you are referring to that would be arising out of a state agency action to enforce party compliance?
That would be an action in state district court to enforce a statute, rule, or regulation under an enforcement provision in a statute. For example, for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, they have the authority under Minnesota Statutes 115.071. If they can't negotiate a settlement, they can take a case to the state district court and file a civil action. That's what happened in the case that I described where I was before a district court judge. They also have a separate administrative penalty order authority that's an administrative process that has district court review. And so those are the two areas that I believe where you'd be in front of a district court as a result of a state agency action.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is Commissioner Michelle Beeman here? Commissioner, we breezed past the fact that there were other people in the room that wanted to give testimony. If you wish, you could approach the table. And if there's anyone else who wishes to speak for or against the bill, if you could just raise your hand so I know. And I think you're it, Commissioner, so please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Michelle Beeman. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency handling legal and enforcement policy. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak to this. And I actually wanted to start by saying I'm also pleased to see that the scope through the Delete All Amendment has really narrowed down the range of concerns that we have and a number of the other agencies, I think, had with the bill as it was originally drafted. Also, I want to say up front that a number of the other administrative agencies, Commerce, Indeed, and Admin, and Health, and MnDOT, all have some similar concerns about what remains, I believe, in this amended bill. As you've heard, what the two key focus areas, and the PCA seems to be the agency, at least today, of concern in raising this, is how the agencies are applying penalties and basically accomplishing compliance and enforcement. And I just want to start by putting a little context. The PCA, we regulate about 15,000 entities, and in any given year, only about 10% of them are even subject to some sort of enforcement action. And of that set, only 1% actually potentially faces a penalty. And most of those are forgivable. So we really are talking about a very, very, very small subset of all of the regulated entities, again, most of whom stay in compliance. And so I wanted to also say up front, the laws that this body passes, we are charged with enforcing. We are charged with upholding the water and air and land regulations that you want to see enforced. In this very small number of cases, we will take an enforcement action. Like I say, most of the time, it is to get a corrective action. It's to fix the pollution problem. We're not about just collecting penalties. What we want to see is that the air pollution or the water pollution or the spill on the ground is cleaned up. What this potentially does is make that more complicated in how we go about our business, adding more time to resolving matters, which I don't think is an advantage to small businesses or other regulated parties. And then particularly on the attorney's fee side, it raises a cloud of issues around how we do our business and whether we are going to be hamstrung, actually, in doing some negotiating on the ultimate outcome, because we're worried that if we change the demand, which is somewhat ill-defined up front, to where we end up with a party, are we then going to be potentially looking at paying the attorney's fees for having resolved that matter to the benefit of the regulated party, but where the end result is different from the beginning result? The level playing field that we like to enforce is that companies are spending money every day to stay in compliance with the laws passed by the legislature. For parties to now be able to come in and argue we don't have the ability to pay or we should have these additional factors taken into account, we do that. But again, keep in mind, you're potentially creating the opportunity for some to have an advantage over others that did the right thing up front. The PCA has a number of those of the criteria for how we calculate penalties already in statute. We have no concerns about continuing to be very transparent about, in those enforcement actions, how we calculate the penalties, with making that available, and we do make that available to the parties in the enforcement action. We are not aware of any situation where we got to a contested case with a party and that party did not have the basis for our penalty calculation. So I'm not sure what the problem there is that seemingly needs fixing, at least from the PCA, on the PCA side. We also have the ability to pay, and these other economic factors are something we do take into account after the penalty is assessed, and we are working with a party because, again, our goal at the end of the day is the compliance, is the cleaning up of the issue. The penalty is the secondary matter for deterrence. By adding in the additional ability to seek attorney's fees if there is a decision by the court or the ALJ that somehow the initial demand is, quote unquote, substantially in excess of what was ended up, it's a second bite at the apple to what's already in statute under the Equal Access to Justice. Under the statute as written, if a state agency's position is not substantially justified, we can be subject to paying the costs and the fees. If we're not substantially justified, then the penalty shouldn't be there. And now you've got a second bite at the apple. Even if we were upheld as to having a substantially justified case, but the judge or the ALJ were recommending a different penalty, suddenly we're still having to pay the attorney's fees. We're just not aware of many situations where this is an issue. So we do not see this as a big problem needing fixing. As was quoted, in the last 20 years, there haven't been that many Equal Access to Justice Act complaints. So it doesn't seem to me as though the agencies are running amok and needing reining in on arbitrary or otherwise unusual penalty actions. But what this does is it puts a lot more hoops and potential concern for paying taxpayer dollars out to attorneys for taking the enforcement actions that we are charged to do to enforce the laws that you pass. So those two areas, we just think this is not a broad problem. We believe that we're very transparent in how we calculate the penalties. And we think what's already in statute, allowing people to challenge if we don't have a substantially justified position for them to seek fees, is sufficient and covers the whole range of potential situations that are out there. So,
thank you, Commissioner. Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of things I'd like to highlight. The Assistant Commissioner said, quote, only 10% of businesses are subject to such an inquiry on an annual basis. That doesn't sound like only to me. If 1 out of 10 businesses are in a situation where they've got to potentially be subject to this kind of an investigation, for the average small business person, that's a very difficult situation to go through. And I would certainly submit that if this agency and other agencies are essentially doing these things already, which seem to be the implication, then there will be no problem. But in my view, it is still reasonable to put some accountability in and make sure that when agencies are assessing a penalty, that they do the best that they can to make an accurate assessment and not, you know, look, we all understand that in litigation, oftentimes, you know, the plaintiff in a personal injury case makes a demand for 4 or 5 or 10 times more than they ultimately think they would be willing to accept in a settlement. But that's just not reasonable to do to a business that that may not have the ability to pay. Or if they do, they may have to put off hiring decisions or expansion decisions to keep that money available to pay. So it strikes me that accountability is a reasonable thing, and that's what this bill does.
Pardon me, Senator Thompson. Are there any questions? Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, could fiscal staff explain the fiscal note, please?
Senator Latz, we can go in a little bit into the fiscal issue, but this is a policy committee, and this is going to the finance committee after this.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, passes. I thought we were a budget committee as well as a policy committee.
Yeah, well, we are.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz.
Mr. Turner.
We got the fiscal note yesterday. The reason we're not going to discuss it much in this committee is because none of the accounts are our accounts. So it, you know, the discussion will take place in full finance. It came here first. We made the request for the fiscal note because when it was obvious there was going to be an expense. And so I made the request, but we don't have the jurisdiction over any of the accounts that are affected. So that discussion will take place in finance. Although I'll point out the biggest expense will be the estimates of the Attorney General for increased litigation costs, and that comes to approximately $1.1 million per year.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, does that be the litigation costs, and would the if there were attorney's fees imposed, would those payments then come out of the enforcing agency's budget, such as the Department of Commerce or the PCA? Is that the way this is set up?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, I believe that's the case, yes. And this is the people who made the fiscal note say this is very highly speculative. There's you know, I haven't even had time to read it yet, other than the basic assumptions. And I don't think that anyone really knows exactly, you know, what this is going to cost.
All right. Mr. Chairman,
Latz.
And maybe I missed something in the description of the bill, but does the Equal Access to Justice Act presently provide for the fee-shifting provisions or the award of attorney's fees under any circumstances in these enforcement actions?
Mr. Chairman, I will allow Mr. Matanowski to address the interaction between these two bodies of law.
Mr. Matanowski.
Thank you, Senator Latz. The current Equal Access to Justice Act does shift fees from, you have to be a prevailing party, and then if the court determines you meet the standards, this would be a new standard for excessive demand, then the agency itself would pay the fees. I would like to point out, I don't know how, I think the $1 million a year estimate may be way overinflated. I'm not sure if the MPCA has had an equal access to justice case in the last 5 years. So I think to say that would occur every year is overstated.
Mr. Chairman, so if I understand this, then current law is you have to be a prevailing party, and this would allow it even if you don't prevail, but that the judge, that there's some disparity between what the agency was asking for and what the judge ultimately concludes is awarded?
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Latz, my understanding, and Mr. Matanowski can address this if I'm wrong, is that prevailing party has been interpreted as zero comes out of it. The reason we've changed this language to the penalty becoming substantially less than the demand is that, you know, We assume that agencies don't bring completely frivolous cases very often where nothing is awarded, but I think we would all agree that if, to use the example that was used, a $100,000 penalty was sought, and it turns out to be 3.5% of that, for all intents and purposes, the subject of the investigation did prevail, but the standard really shouldn't be zero. It should be that if the agency is looking for, you know, multiple times what the ultimate assessment ends up being, that that individual that was subject to that investigation should have some recourse.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Lance.
Either Senator Thompson or Mr. Matanowski or Senate counsel, is there any other place in Minnesota law where prevailing party is defined something like this instead of, you know, a complete win or loss?
Senator Latz, I'm going to ask counsel to see if she might be able to lend some light on that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, the only thing that jumps to mind right now is like in the eminent domain law for the award of attorney fees, there's kind of a tiered award there based on the difference between the initial offer versus, you know, what the final dollar amount is that's awarded and whether you can get attorney fees or must get attorney fees. And prevailing party here, it's not actually defined under the statute. I think this has all come up under case law. The substantially justified is defined, but you really have to look at the case law, both state and I think federal, because it's somewhat analogous to find out what that means. But.
So, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Pontius, what does it mean in the case law then?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I haven't looked into it.
Mr. Chairman, this sounds like a pretty radical change in existing Minnesota law relating to defining prevailing party, with the perhaps the exception of eminent domain law, which is kind of its own unique animal. And I don't know. I think I'd like to have some more information before we make such a dramatic change. I might kind of like this change to apply to a lot of other areas of fee-shifting provisions as well. Or maybe I'd hate that it does that, and maybe members of this committee would hate expanding this to other areas that in every other way might be analogous. So I think we ought to be really cautious before we take this step.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, it really isn't my intent to change a definition of prevailing party. The definition of prevailing party in other instances has been determined apparently and sometimes by the court, sometimes by statute. The purpose, for me at least, in this legislation is not to define anyone as a prevailing party. It's to say that if somebody has been subjected to the threat of a penalty that doesn't seem to be justified based upon the outcome of the case, that the person, business, who has suffered the consequences of that should have recourse. And so I don't necessarily want to call it prevailing party. I simply want to say that it seems reasonable to me that if someone ends up having to pay only a fraction of what the agency sought, they should be helped in their defense of that case.
Commissioner Beaman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in two responses. The concern is that that's correct. This language would not change prevailing party. It would say even if the state agency has prevailed, has proved up its case that there was a violation, but that there was an ultimate decision to reduce the penalty to some amount that's viewed as substantial, that suddenly the state is paying the entire cost of the other side being part of that, even when they've proved up their case that there was a problem and a violation. We think that is a very, very big expansion, and it applies to all state agencies, even though PCA seems to be the one in focus. But what I would also point out is the point about bringing this additional information in for evaluating the penalty, ability to pay, other economic circumstances, I think is designed for the agency to take those things into account to potentially reduce the penalty. So we're starting with the demand based on very strict criteria. But we would be willing to move down from that, except that now we're going to have this stick that says, well, if you move down too much or if the court wants to take those things into account and the number gets too small, then you're going to have to pay too. So there is a built-in disincentive there that I'm not seeing as being very helpful to.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Matanowski can correct me if I'm wrong, but it is common in negotiating any sort of civil legal case to choose to waive rights. So if, as the assistant commissioner suggests, say I was were in a dispute with the PCA and they were saying I owed $75,000, we chose to settle at $40,000, if she was concerned that I could then seek attorney fees, that could certainly be a part of the agreement that I would not do that. So it's that's something that wouldn't be automatic. It could be negotiated by the parties. And I'm assuming, like in virtually every other area of civil law, the vast majority of the time would be negotiated.
Any other discussion? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Hearing none, Senator Thompson renews his motion that Senate File 1298 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the Senate Finance or the Senate State Government Committee. Any further questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Appreciate your attention.
Thank you, Senator Thompson. There's no further business before the committee. The meeting stands adjourned.
I can pass this over for now.